I'm turning this evening to the book of Job, chapter 1 and verse 1. Job 1, verse 1, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was perfect and upright, and one that feared God and eschewed evil. And our subject will be Key Lessons from Job, or more elaborately, Key Lessons from the Fall and Rise of Job. And this takes us back to this first chapter of the book of Job, one of the oldest books in the Bible, so it is thought. Job would have been a very approximate contemporary of Abraham of old, living in another region and related to him. Here it is, the book of Job, a mystery to so many people, a book of amazing poetry from end to end. And we embark upon a series of studies. But I cannot undertake the fullest series. There is so much to the book of Job. But just to go through, to show over, God willing, a period of sessions, the main spiritual lessons for God's people in all ages. Though the book is worthy of far deeper exploration, examination, than we shall be able to give it. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. Very straightforward introduction for such an elaborately poetic book. And that man, and here are the terms, was perfect, meaning entire, complete. And that we can see as indicating two things. In the language of Scripture, he was a saved man. He was a converted man. He was complete in the most important sense. He was not only bodily alive, obviously, but he was spiritually alive. His soul had found life. He'd come to God, and he walked with him and knew him. He engaged with God. He's a complete man in that sense. But it also is used in another sense, the word perfect, in the Old Testament and in the New, and that is to indicate that in every department of his life, Job was consistent. There wasn't some glaring omission, as there is so often with all of us. Good at this, in terms of character and behavior, not at all good at something else. Job was perfect. He was seemingly unblemished. You can use the word in that sense. And he was upright. He was respected by all, and he stood. But there's another word which consolidates this even more. One that feared God, well, we value that, had great respect for the living God, and eschewed evil, which is a very precious word. And the Hebrew indicates to us that he acted against evil. It's a very active kind of word. He put it away. He opposed it. He didn't merely abstain from it. He resisted it actively in his life and in his circle. Anybody put to him something that was suspect, then he would repudiate it and resist it and could be relied upon for that. He was engaged in a battle with sin and wrongdoing, and he eschewed, or he opposed actively, evil. That's a very interesting description of him altogether. But he was undoubtedly a godly man, and he was a sanctified man, and that's established in verse 1. So in the book of Job, we will certainly see some weaknesses in him. But at the same time, we always handle them carefully, because we have this tremendous commendation of his character, his integrity, his consistency, right at the beginning of this inspired book. We read of his family in verse 2, his seven sons and three daughters, and his substance in verse 3, his thousands of camels and sheep and oxen and she-asses and a very great household, servants, everybody, so that this man was the greatest of all the men of the East in all the terms that have just been described. He was famous, not only in his region, but beyond his region. And he was probably famous for things that are not mentioned in the book of Job, but only implied. When we see his poetic powers, and given time, we'll see just a shot of that even this evening, we can imagine that his poetry was recited far and wide. This was an age of poetry. However, we can see all manner of reasons why he would have been very widely spoken of and well known, and that's implied throughout the book. And verse 4, his sons went and feasted in their houses, every one his day, whatever that might have been, his birthday or his special celebration for something. He was a family man, and he'd established this system of get-togethers for the entire family and celebration, and they occurred regularly with all the children and adult children, and sent and called for their three sisters to eat and to drink with them. Verse 5, and it was so, when the days of their feastings were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them. He pastored his family, rose up early in the morning, offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus did Job continually. And we may assume from what we read elsewhere in the book about all the counsel he was famous for giving many different people and all the advice and assistance frequently referred to, we may assume that if he sacrificed for his children, he also preached to his children in a fatherly manner in his home. He had a reputation for his caring and pastoral approach. So I think the information in verse 5 about the sacrifices leads us to realize that he spoke to them earnestly and helped them all spiritually. And verse 6 brings us now to a view of the celestial war, the war between God and Satan, between God and the fallen angels. Now there was a day, says our translation. And this has been handled differently, going way back by different translations. It may be more accurate simply to say, and the day came, or a day came. Our translation implies there was a special day set. The original doesn't quite say that. But the day came, the great day came, when the sons of God, which is all the angels, came to present themselves before the Lord. And straight away we're into an account which has been accommodated to human understanding. I think it's fair to assume that the angels are under review by God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, constantly. There is not a second in the heavenly realm when the angels are not under review, observed, and their obedience and their conduct and their worship is noted continually by God. But this is some molded for human understanding. And because we live in time and we don't think of all things all the time as God does and the angels, it's accommodated to us. And so God is portrayed in these words more like a great nobleman or king on earth who would have to summon all his subordinate officers and regional authorities to the palace and examine them on certain days or review their work. So the day comes when all the regional officers are gathered together. But don't worry, in heaven there may not be such a day, but it may be a continuous divine activity. It's expressed for us in the language of the book of Job. There came a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan, who is fallen, came also among them, and he's held to account. Now our narrative is going to give the impression of a face-to-face conversation between God and Satan. But what actually happened would be beyond our comprehension and understanding. It's put in a form that we can visualize. And the Lord said unto Satan, "Whence comest thou?" And Satan answered, "From going to and fro in the earth and walking up and down on it." Well, of course, Satan's activity, as far as the world is concerned, is to tempt and to destroy, to tempt people and to seek to bring about their murder by engineering their spiritual fall and rebellion against God. But his statement is from examining the earth. Why has he come? Or why is he portrayed as coming before the Lord along with the angelic host, when it probably literally couldn't have happened? Well, it shows the self-justification and, if you like, the self-righteousness of Satan. He does not see himself as fallen. He sees himself as equal with God. He sees himself as wrongly dealt with by God. He is in a state of constant self-justification. He's been given over to his lies, and he fools even himself. And the Lord said unto Satan, verse 8, "Hast thou considered my servant Job?" And now you come to a deeply mysterious element in the book, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, and so on, one that fears God and fights against, actively opposes evil. And now you see that Job is appointed by God to be, in a way, the representative of converted people. Here is Job. He walks with God. He isn't one of Satan's. He's so different. He loves God. And so he is appointed as the representative of God's converted people. Well, there's a sense in which every one of us is a representative of God's appointed people. So we're interested particularly in what happened to Job in this appointment, in this calling. Verse 9, "Then Satan answered the Lord and said, Doth Job fear God for naught?" Do you think this supposed spiritual man who walks in communion with you, who has been converted, as people put it, to you, do you think he does that for nothing? Do you think that's genuine? Satan's thesis will be there's no such thing as a genuine man or woman. And anybody who professes Christ or conversion or religious faith according to the scriptures, well, they're just doing it for what they get out of it. It's not genuine. There has been no real work, no effectual work in the soul. Take away their substance, they will fall. Ultimately, he will fail in that, Satan. So he'll change the terms. Take away their health and well-being and put them on the edge of death, they will turn and deny him. And Job is going to be the representative of the Lord's people, who is to prove, though he doesn't see it this way and he doesn't realize it, is to prove the integrity and the efficacy of conversion to Christ. Verse 10, Satan charges, Hast not thou made a hedge about him and about his house? He's protected by you. Everything he does is blessed. His substance is increased. Verse 11, put forth thine hand now and touch all that he hath, and he will curse thee to thy face. And verse 12, the Lord said unto Satan, behold, all that he hath is in thy power. You notice, Satan has to apply for consent. He doesn't have the power to take away the health of Job. He doesn't have the power to take away the health of anyone. God must permit him that power in order for him to do it. And in verse 12, this unusual permission is given. So Satan went forth. And then there is the sorry narrative, which I won't go into at detail. Satan strikes at Thanksgiving time, a day when the sons and daughters were eating and drinking in the eldest son's house, one of the birthdays, one of the days of festivity and thanksgiving to God for life and abundance and blessing and provision. And at such a time, Satan strikes. Well, that's a permanent lesson for us too. Satan strikes. He cannot stand the people of God praising God, giving thanks, rejoicing, being happy. And he chooses such a moment to strike, and the messengers come, and the oxen and their farmers are taken, and then the sheep and the shepherds are subsequently taken, and the camels and their drivers are taken, and then the sons and the daughters are taken, and Job is deprived of everything, and plunged, we may be sure, into utter poverty and destitution overnight, suddenly. And of course, the tragedy and the heartache of family loss. Verse 20, then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped. Astonishing, his love and trust for God was as yet unbroken, and said, naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. It's all on loan. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. So we come to chapter 2. And again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves. And the text runs rather as in the first chapter. And the Lord says to Satan, well, have you considered Job? He stood no matter what you did. And verse 4, Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin, yea, all that a man hath will he give for his life. But put forth thine hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse thee to thy face. And he received permission to do it. And verse 7, you read of the sore boils from the sole of his foot unto his crown. And pathetically he took him a potsherd to scrape himself, and he sat down among the ashes in utter dejection and dismay, tormenting pain, painful, incapacitating, and surely on the verge of death. Verse 9, it's so sad. Then said his wife unto him, Dost thou still retain thine integrity? Are you keeping up this performance? She might as well say, Curse God and die. You're at the point of death. Many people say she urges him to suicide. Well, that's not absolutely clear, but still not very wifely. Job's wife, she knows she's crushed. She's never seen him like this. It comes at a total shock, and like him, she too has been plunged into destitution and utter poverty. They've lost everything. Yes, she's had an immense shock, but oh, let's hope that Christian people are never like Job's wife, that wives stand by husbands and are supportive no matter what, in love and sympathy, and husbands, of course, stand by their wives no matter what, in love and sympathy. The syndrome of Job's wife, what a sad, sad thing if it comes among believers. Verse 10, but he said unto her, I'm sure gently, thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh. What? Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this did not Job sin with his lips. Now the so-called comforters. A new heading here. The comforters. Verse 11. They came with good intentions. When Job's three friends heard of all this evil. We can read a lot into that. I would have expected Job to have scores of friends, even hundreds of friends. When you read the book and you see how philanthropic he was and how many poor he helped and how many wretched and destitute people he rescued and how many sick he paid for to have attention and care, when you read some of his works that are mentioned in the course of the book, you'd expect him to have more than three friends. And yet, right early in the book, we read about his three friends. And although I'm not going to pursue this right now, here is already a hint of one of Job's big mistakes, because though he's an utterly godly man and a grand man, and one hesitates to be critical of Job in any way, his three distinctive friends were unbelievers. His three distinctive friends gained their station by being, like him, wonderfully accomplished men of letters. He had in common with them a powerful literary gift, genius even, and that drew them together and bound them together and made them special friends. That really is a very dangerous situation for a believer, for people other than believers to be their special friends. But you get the hint of this here, one of the openings for trouble. However, we'll pursue that later on. For the moment, in verse 11, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, for they had made an appointment together to come to mourn with him and to comfort him. How much did they know? I think there was probably quite a gap between Job losing his substance and his children, and Job losing his health and his strength. Certainly the narrative suggests a gap, with the very elaborate beginning to each episode And the day came when the sons of God came before the Lord, and then the same formula is repeated, and it suggests a little gap. And I mention this because it would seem that the three friends probably knew about the destitution and the loss, but probably not about the loss of health and the near to dying state that they would find Job in. Because verse 12 finds them utterly shocked to see his condition. I think it suggests this is new. They didn't expect this. And when they lifted up their eyes afar off and knew him not, unrecognizable, they lifted up their voice and wept, and they rent every one his mantle and sprinkled dust upon their heads toward heaven. So they sat down with him upon the ground 7 days and seven nights. That's quite a vigil. And none spake a word unto him, for they saw that his grief was very great. You don't find this today, but in olden cultures, there was the idea that if you wished to identify with someone who was suffering, you really needed to suffer yourself to somehow convey that solidarity and sympathy. So for 7 days and seven nights, they became as he was, and they squatted on the ground without food, and they just identified, and nobody said a word. That kind of thing we don't find today. I'm not saying one way or the other what the usefulness of it is, but just showing what they did then. But they were shocked for themselves, because you see, these three were religious men, these friends, but not like Job, an enlightened man. They didn't know about the grace of God. They didn't know about the need for forgiveness. They didn't know about the need to come to God in repentance and faith, and to find him personally, and to walk with him, and to strive after righteousness. Their religion wasn't like that. It was rather akin to the religion of theological liberals. There was no personal, deep personal encounter with God or experience. And in fact, there were many faults in their theology. All the comforters believed that prosperity was a sign of your acceptance with God, and calamity was a sure sign of your being under God's judgment. Well, Job irritated them. In many ways, this comes out in the course of the book. His exclusive religious stand, he witnessed to them. He told them they needed the righteousness of God to be imputed to them. And they hated this. We are like you. We are children of God. Your language to us suggests that we're not. We find that offensive, insulting even. They were often irritated with God. The text says so as you go through. But nevertheless, if Job has been struck down, how do we account for this? Our theology, said these friends, our theology tells us that he's under judgment, that he's been a hypocrite to be so struck down. We've got to account for him, or we feel insecure. You can almost hear their thinking. It could happen to us, unless we can say, Job's this way because he deserves it. And this is the conclusion which they all come to. And in chapter 3, Job at last breaks down, and his firm trust seems to waver. And there is this astonishing piece of poetry. Job rates his birth as the greatest imaginable tragedy. Birth is celebrated. Baby boy, baby girl, celebrated, Thanksgiving, everybody happy. But this birth was nothing but a tragedy. And if you read these verses, look, let me just read a passage from chapter 3 and verse 2. Job spake and said, "Let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night in which it was said, there is a man-child conceived." These are going to be his words. This is extemporaneous. This is just straight off. He utters this astonishing poem. "Let that day be in darkness. Let not God regard it from above, neither let the light shine upon it. Let darkness and the shadow of death stain it. Let a cloud dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, let darkness seize upon it. Let it not be joined unto the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Lo, let that night be solitary. Let no joyful voice come therein. Let them curse it that curse the day, who are ready to raise up their mourning. Let the stars at the twilight thereof be dark. Let it look for light, but have none. Neither let it see the dawning of the day, because it shut not up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hid sorrow from mine eyes," and so on. It is astonishing material. And that is the great lament of Job. But Job, we may say, looking back, it's not so. That great lament, it's nonsense, Job, that the day of your birth should be so cursed and regarded with such dismay. You've had years of blessing. You're now in your 50s, we would reckon, from what's the information in the book. You've had years of salvation and light. You've had a testimony. Testimony to the distinguished, to your fellow poets. So much worship and light. 50 years plus of worship of God in vain, bringing no glory to him, plus the unknown future. Here's where faith comes in. Job, if only you could see your future. If only you could see, we can see it. What will happen to you with the passing of time? In no time at all, you'll have great light on the Redeemer. More light than Abraham was given. On the purchase price paid for sinners and the love of the Redeemer. On eternity and eternal glory. You'll have more light on life and God's ways towards his people. You'll have massive vindication. All the people who opposed you and cursed you, they would all be put to shame. Your family will be renewed and your wealth. Friendships will be realigned. You'll be brought into oneness with great saints like Elihu, who you barely knew, and severed to some extent from those with no spiritual light. Riches restored, Job couldn't see what would come. So he's all wrong. The poetry is magnificent. The substance of it is rubbish and nonsense. What a lesson for us, dear friends, in our worst moments, in our gloomiest moments, in our depressed moments, you might say, in our faithless moments, And we forget all the good that we've received. And we have no insight into the good that we shall receive. Job didn't know. He had no idea what nonsense he would be speaking with such flair and beauty. The book of Job, it's quite extraordinary. We've time just for a very short look at the first attack of the first so-called friend in chapter 4. Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, and right from the beginning he's giving notice that he's coming in on the attack. If we essay to commune with thee, wilt thou be grieved? But who can withhold himself from speaking? Behold, thou hast instructed many, but thou hast strengthened the weak hands. They know Job. They're acknowledging here, before they attack him, that he's been a kindly counselor to many people. Verse 4, thy words have upholden him that was falling, and thou hast strengthened the feeble knees. But now it is come upon thee, and thou faintest. It toucheth thee, and thou art troubled. And the conclusion he draws, Job, you've been a secret hypocrite. You must have been. Verse 7, whoever perished being innocent. You can see his theology coming out. This couldn't have happened to you if you hadn't been a hypocrite. Or where were the righteous cut off? And so he proceeds, and the attack begins. But we're through our time. And that's more than enough for us this evening. When Job is down and he's utterly dismayed and he's very sick and he's completely undermined, then the devil comes in through his agent to rock his theology. He's going to rock Job's beliefs. And we shall see what Eliphaz does. He won't succeed, but you can see Satan's strategy. Have you not had this? When things have conspired against you in some way, and you've been very down, and on top of that, even theological doubts get thrown in. The devil never shows any originality. His methods are always the same. But this is enough for us. It's our introduction to the book.